Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the aftermath of massive wildfires that burned across much of western Oregon last summer, an inevitable slew of post-fire logging proposals threatens to clear-cut over 10,000 acres of fire-impacted federal lands along the iconic Mackenzie and North Umpqua rivers. Today on this special International Women's Day edition of Locus Focus, we talk about the need to protect burned forests, not destroy them, with Samantha Kropp, a community organizer working at the intersection of forest defense, climate justice, and feminism. Samantha, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you describe your work as being at the intersection of forest defense and climate justice. So what does that mean?
Yes, I like to describe my work as being at the intersection of forest defense and climate defense, which really is kind of a new movement that we're seeing in folks who are doing grassroots activism for climate, which is a recognition of the role that our forests actually play in that work, both in a defensive and in an offensive way, actually. So recognizing that, especially us Pacific Northwesterners out here, we have this really incredible tool, our amazing forest lands that not only sequester and store carbon, so they help us deal and mitigate with climate change in that way, but they also help our communities safeguard against some of the worst potential effects of the climate crisis, such as drought and wildfire. And so really, we like to say forest defense is climate defense, is community defense.
Well, for this show, since this is our special International Women's Day show, we added another intersection as well, which is the intersection of feminism with all this. And I think that it would probably be true to say that the traditional outlook about forests is relatively patriarchal, if not totally patriarchal, and very disconnected from nature. And I wonder how putting a feminist perspective onto the struggle to protect our forests and to really encourage them to thrive, how does that intersect with the other struggles that you're working with right now?
Yeah, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to be on here for International Women's Day and to be able to speak to intersectionality, which is something that also, you know, as our movement starts to recognize more the intersection of forests and climate, we also start to recognize the intersection of environmental justice, social justice in this calculation. And so, you know, we're recognizing that all types of oppression are connected. The oppression of the earth comes from essentially the same kind of logic of domination that has historically made it okay to oppress women and LGBTQ members of the community, Black and Indigenous communities, people of color. It's this, you know, sort of logic of domination that justifies some, historically mostly cis white men, doing what they want to others. And it makes most people stop asking questions about why, you know, why it's okay to do that thing. And, you know, it's, we can draw, and we're beginning to draw more and more of these connections and this intersections between the same imperative, the same patriarchally rooted imperative that makes it okay to, you know, clear cut a landscape and leave behind nothing to deplete biodiversity, makes it okay to, you know, assault others, to oppress others, to marginalize others, to discriminate. And so we're seeing those connections more and more, and that's really, really important. And I also would just, you know, I think an important piece of this when we talk about feminism and women's issues and the connections with forest defense is that our movement, our forest defense movement, has not historically been an inclusive space. Historically, the forest defense and conservation movement in general has been dominated and by outspoken white males who have historically, you know, led the movement in direction of the movement. And now more and more we are seeing a diversification of the conservation and forest defense movement. We're seeing more women leaders in the forest defense movement. But we're also, you know, still quite homogenous and white dominant. And so I think that's an important piece too, is that in our work together on forest defense, we have to be, you know, we have to be actively working to advance diversity and actively working to center the people who are most impacted by the things that are happening in our forests. And this, you know, obviously includes women, the ones who are most impacted. Like, so much of what's happening in the forest impacts climate change and makes logging makes climate change worse. Of course, you know, who's impacted first and worst by climate change? So I guess I would say, you know, we as women are often the first affected and last consulted, and we share, you know, in this situation with all of our other LGBTQ communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities who have experienced a similar kind of oppression, and we share that with our forests who are experiencing it all the time now.
Well, while it's true that I think that the stereotype of an environmental activist is a white guy, and I was thinking about the two polls, though, that pulled apart in Earth First a number of years ago. This is during the forest wars in Northern California and in Oregon. And on the one hand, there was the Dave Foreman School of Earth First, which is very macho, and it also involved possible hurting people by spiking trees and doing things that were not very helpful to actually create dialogue. And then there was Judy Berry in Mendocino County, who came out of the union organizing movement and who was really into learning how to relate to loggers and to speak to them in their own terms and to really share her values with them. And she was completely nonviolent. But I think about those two things and I think, well, Judy Berry's spirit in some ways is so much bigger now in the environmental movement than I think Dave Foreman's was. And then I also think about Julia Butterfly, who was up in the Tree Luna for, I don't know, like a year and a half. She came from this totally other place, which is really a love and connection to the forest and to the trees. And to me, that's a woman's connection to forests. And I wonder if we can talk about how that is so different from the traditional male approach to protecting forests.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to be, you know, careful about being essentialist in saying that there is a way that women interact with forests that is kind of across the board versus the way that men do. I would say that there are tendencies like the logic of domination that have historically tended to be picked up by men and used in ways that you talk about to kind of deal with nature in an othering, to deal with nature as like a, we're, it's out there, we're over here, and maybe we can save it, maybe we have a savior complex, but we're certainly not a part of it. We're upper, you know, we have a power over. And I think that that is and has been really toxic in the way that it's played out in our culture. And certainly, you know, I think one interesting parallel is that, you know, going on to the extreme of this, you know, those who have, you know, pretty ultra conservative, pretty right, anti-feminist worldviews also always typically, you know, that those worldviews often come hand in hand with a dismissiveness of environmental concerns. And so we have to pay attention to like how those things connect and how they play together. And in the same way, in a way that I am very proud of our movement for, political views that are more socially accepting and feminist and inclusive and thoughtful and caring also tend to be paired with perspectives that see us as connected to the earth and as a part of the system. I think that's important.
Well, I think that one of the real divergent points is, I think it's becoming more and more old school view of forests, which is that old forests are decadent and they need to be cut down so you can have healthy young forests. And that trees are just trees and they're inanimate and they just basically are all individual trees. And science has shown that, first of all, trees do not live independently of each other. Trees are a very strong communal creature, and that, in fact, they are creatures in a lot of ways. They have all kinds of ways of communicating with each other and, I think, with other species as well. And so there's a whole interdependence in the forest between all the different plants and animals that live there. To me, that is a much more of a feminist perspective than the one where you just want to cut down the forest and plant it and control it and have it all be in neat rows. And I think of men doing things in straight lines and women doing things in circles and in curves and in shapes that are much harder to rationalize.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you point out just the difference in perceiving a forest as a complex being and perceiving a forest as kind of a bunch of independent things. And I think that's, you know, interestingly, a tendency of our of just, you know, the dominant culture and the industrial culture and, you know, our culture being so focused on independence and autonomy and production, you know, and I think most people across the country see and think of Oregon's forests as producers of timber. And we certainly, these forests certainly are, but obviously they're about so much more than that. And I think, you know, another interesting piece about this more holistic worldview, like seeing this as more, you know, forests as more than timber, forests as more than individual trees, but for the value of their connectedness, comes from place-based cultures, comes from cultures that are rooted in place, which still, you know, are working hard to maintain autonomy and fight against some of this extraction that is defining the landscape. So yeah, I think that's a really important distinction that you just brought up, and also one that plays out a lot in post-fire logging situations, in the way that people think about and talk about and kind of portray the differences between, you know, a fire-burned forest and a not fire-burned forest.
Well, let's get into that, because that's actually the impetus for this show, was a letter that was sent by numerous environmental groups across the spectrum to Oregon's congressional delegation to urge them to stop post-fire logging as in the Umpqua and along the Mackenzie River as a result of the fires that burned in the fall. So I'd like to talk about why the first impulse on the part of the Forest Service and a lot of politicians, and they're not all Republicans, after there's a fire, let's go in and log it.
Yeah, so that is the impulse on behalf of forest managers, and we can talk about the larger landscape, but it does happen across the board, federal, state, and local forest managers, and private forest managers, of course, tend to first reaction want to log right after a fire. And there can be a couple different justifications for that. Usually, and often, especially on private lands, the justification is simply for economic recovery or salvaging of profits. And so that's why we often hear the term salvage logging for post-fire logging, which we conservationists and grassroots community members try not to use, because we don't want to put the focus on the money, because there's, like we said, so much more, there's such of a bigger holistic perspective going on in a post-fire forest than just money. But that is the number one reason why that happens, is those trees, once they've been topped off by flame, are only economically viable for another couple years. And then they can't be sold on the market. And so the idea is that we need to, quote, salvage or take, you know, all these trees and sell them quick before they go bad and become worthless. But I also want to address a more sneaky reason why people tend and sometimes do post-fire logging, which is important for us to dig into, which is sometimes post-fire logging is done in the name of forest restoration. And that we can definitely dig into, but I would say, just as a gateway sentence, that doing post-fire logging is, ecologically speaking, the worst thing you can do on a forest landscape.
And why is that?
It's a big story, but we could start with saying that our forests are dependent and used to and adapted to fire, especially the forests out here in the Pacific Northwest. They have always burned, and they will burn again. And that's something that it's so important for us to recognize. And, you know, many of our forests are fire dependent, meaning that, you know, certain trees actually require flame in order to germinate and spread. And other forests and trees are fire resilient, like, you know, Douglas fir, they get old enough and they get like a fireproof coat. And so fire has an important place in the forest. You know, when you assume that we humans, you know best what to do in a post-fire forest, we're essentially suggesting that the entire history of this landscape has been done wrong before humans have come in and done management, and that, you know, nature doesn't know best. And so I would say, you know, fire belongs here. Forests love it. fire when it's an issue. It's for an issue for our communities. And it is an issue for our communities. And when we talk about doing things in a fire resilient and fire thriving world, we need to focus on our communities and how to protect them. But when we're talking about forests, these forests want to burn. And every piece of science that we have now shows that these fires are not burning hotter. They're not harming forests. They are, you know, on the historical fire regime, appropriate, if not far less than what they burned on a historical timescale. You know, the idea that we should do logging to benefit the ecology of a forest after a fire is just absurd, ecologically speaking. And it does far more damage, which we can talk about too.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFTLPFM and KODXLPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with community organizer Samantha Kropp, who's with Forest Waters. And we're talking about the intersection of forest protection, climate justice, and feminism. Well, when you're talking about how some scientists, the ones who are paid by the timber companies, believe that nature doesn't do it right, and it's up to human beings to really make forests work better. And it reminds me of this laser light show I saw years ago on the face of Grand Coulee Dam that basically talked about what an amazing thing the Grand Coulee Dam was, because it corrected this deficit in nature. Because here was this great river, and here was this really fertile ground, but God had not put the river to irrigate the ground. And so therefore, it was up to humans to take the water from where it was originally and put it where it needed to be. And when I saw that, I just had my mind blown. I thought, this really sums up what is wrong with the way that Western society, and particularly male Western society, perceives of nature. So how do you see that playing out in terms of the attitudes towards forests and how to manage forests?
I want to answer that question by telling a story about what happens in even the most severely burned forest patches after a fire, and comparing that reality to the narrative that we get from big timber. And I think that can help illustrate your point. So even in the most severely burned patches of forest, which are in a typical fire, only parts of the overall burn. Typical fires are mixed severities. So you have some areas that are really, really hot, some areas that just do a ground fire and kind of burn up the underbrush. But let's just pick the highest severity, the hottest burn stands. Even there, life returns quickly to the forest. Immediately, there are insects and wood-boring beetles that can smell the smoke and sense the smoke and return to the landscape because they like charred wood and they like to bore in charred wood. And then they attract birds, and there's specific birds who really only hang out in really burned forests, like the black-backed woodpecker and the mountain bluebird. They're super amazing. They come and they eat the beetles because they're really attracted to the beetles. And then they are ecosystem engineers, and so they're kind of pecking out homes for more creatures like small rodents to come back and burrow in. And those rodents are attracting cool, bigger predators like spotted owl, who like to live kind of on the outside of burned forests and kind of like wait and hunt those little rodents that are making their nests in the holes, and in the holes in the trees that the woodpeckers created. And, you know, tons of animals begin to come back. Life begins to come back, even in the most severely burned forest patches. And so that's the true story of what's been happening since time immemorial in this bioregion, without humans having to log afterward. Humans were certainly a part of that fire story. I mean, humans have been setting fires in this place also since time immemorial, and we could talk about that. That's important, our relationship with fire. But we haven't been logging after a fire, and we haven't been interfering with the post-fire process. And compare that with the timber industry narrative, which says something like, well, these forests are no longer economically viable soon. Everything is dead. We need to log everything so that we can make space for new life to come in. And the quicker we can remove all the dead trees and a bunch of also living trees, and, you know, bring our machines in there and build our roads, the quicker we can do all that stuff, the quicker we're going to help the forest recover. So, you know, obviously it's laughable when you put it the way I did, but that's actually what's happening.
Well, why is it so detrimental to bring in this heavy equipment and to get rid of all the, quote, dead trees?
It is a mess to do post-fire logging. It's detrimental in so many ways. So picture a burned forest, sensitive soils, a lot of standing dead trees that are remaining and slowly deteriorating, and a lot of animals that kind of left before the flames to save themselves but are going to start coming back really soon, the process that I just discovered. And so you bring in for logging a bunch of heavy machinery. You build some roads so that you can get to the wood. And those roads and those machines end up compacting the soil. And so you're taking all the sensitive soil and you're pushing it down, compacting it, and also making it more sensitive to future weather events like wind and rain. And so when those weather events do happen, once you've compacted the soil and then pulled up all the trees, those roots are no longer holding the soil in place. And so all of that soil, the topsoil, that precious, important topsoil that holds most of the microorganic life in soil, washes down into the streams, washes down into the roads, washes out of the forest. And so it's horrible for, you know, the soil. And obviously taking out all of these trees is, you know, removing the canopy layer, is making it so that the heat is directly, the sun is directly exposing and charring the soil. There's no protective layer, there's no cooling layer, removing all of the standing dead snags and fallen nurse logs that provide habitat to animals and also store water so that they regulate a forest water intake. All of those things play a role in a forest, and post-fire clear cutting comes in and just messes all of that up, removes everything from the landscape, and it puts all of that sediment, if there's rivers nearby, if there's streams nearby, it's going to put all that sedimentation into the water. And this is an issue for places like Eugene, where they're pulling their drinking water from the Mackenzie River, and the Holiday Farm Fire burns all along the Mackenzie River. And then what do all the private land managers and a lot of federal land managers do? They go in and they try to do post-fire logging, and they put all of the sedimentation into the drinking water of the community. And this is happening all over the place right now. And so, yeah, it's a total mess. And, you know, again, no ecological reason to do that.
Now, has the post-fire logging started already along the Mackenzie and the Umpqua rivers?
Yeah, so let's talk about the current landscape. It has started, and it has started all over the place, and there's a lot of proposals. And so we can break it down to what's happening on federal land, what's happening on state land, and what's happening on private land. And the easiest way to say, you know, is that the private land that's owned by these big timber operators like Weyerhaeuser or Roseburg Forest Products or Roseboro are being logged pretty much lickety-split. And immediately after the fires, there was a glut of burned wood on the market. And so a lot of that has been, you know, quote, liquidated or, quote, salvaged. But there's also, you know, tons and tons and tons of private land that hasn't yet, but will be soon. And there's such precious little that us individuals can do about it, because all of that on private land is at least, you know, legal for those owners to do whatever they want, even if they don't live or work or play near our communities and the impacts they're causing. So that's the sad part. I guess this is all the sad part, but there's varying ways that we can actually do something about it. And there's a lot of great work being done. But there's also logging proposals on federal and state land. The Santiam State Forest out by the town of Gates is currently proposed for huge-scale post-fire logging, all in this recreation area that people love and people use. They have waterfalls and areas of really old forests, and Oregon Department of Forestry is proposing to log it all because they're saying all of it burned. But what we've actually learned recently is that at least, you know, it looks like from what we can see of aerial flyovers, this has only been like a 50% burn rate or mortality rate in the Santiam State Forest. So if they go in there and try and log everything, they're going to be logging a lot of live trees that would live to see the spring and beyond. And then we've got our federal lands, which are, you know, the beloved prize of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. And with those are managed by the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, different areas. And there currently are over 10,000 acres proposed for post-fire logging by Bureau of Land Management. And there's a number of organizations engaging on that, and there's people working to stop it. But the Bureau of Land Management is planning to do some significant salvage logging. And so far, the Forest Service, as far as I know, hasn't proposed any, and that's great. But there have been discussions coming from the Forest Service about introducing some, the Willamette Forest Service. And what we do know is that, sadly, a lot of logging happens under the banner of hazard tree removal along roads and recreation areas. And so they'll remove essentially up to 150 to 200 feet of clear cut on either side of a road so that trees don't fall on cars, which is, you know, it's important for human safety. And we have to recognize the significant impacts that that has all along and up and down the roads when you're, again, you know, causing all those post-fire logging damages to all of these burned forests across our whole state. So cumulatively, it's a major deal, and it's happening all over the state.
Well, is there any way that they can cull the trees that really are a danger to people driving down those roads without taking them all out?
Yes, there are definitely ways to more responsibly deal with hazard trees. And I think that a mixture of it being fully legal under our laws to just go ahead and clear cut along the roads and being easy is why we mostly don't see that sort of site specific and thoughtful tree removal. But there is, you know, most ecologists would recommend that you close what roads and trails that you can until spring, and you see what lives and what dies, that you don't ever remove any living tree that has green needles on it, that you're very thoughtful about what actually makes sense. And I think actually in our own backyard, in Portland's backyard, the Eagle Creek area is a perfect example of very thoughtful and careful hazard tree removal, where I just was enjoying those trails the other week and was walking through the Eagle Creek burn area and admiring how good of a job was done out there by retaining so many trees that are, even a lot of them that were killed by the fire were retained, and they're slowly decaying over, you know, decades and maybe a century. And that's great for the forest. And that should happen. And contrast that with what we're seeing this year. And, you know, to specifically name a management agency that did a shameful job of this is the Willamette Forest Service Detroit Ranger Station, where we, you know, a couple of community members, myself included, went out there to do some photo documentation and saw that they, you know, had clear cut to their full legal ability 150 to 200 feet on either side of the beloved Highway 46 that runs from the town of Detroit to Brighton Bush. And they had just taken all of these gorgeous old growth trees and just been sloppy about it. And including in the Brighton Bush community, the cabin adjacent to the Brighton Bush retreat center, where many private cabin owners kind of have beautiful secluded cabins up there, the Willamette National Forest Detroit Ranger Station decided that for hazardous tree removal, you know, they were going to go in there and remove, essentially clear cut all of the forests around that area, which was, you know, the Spotted Owl Trail, if you're a fan of Brighton Bush and know the area I'm talking about. A lot of these amazing places that I was very connected to, and I know so many people were very connected to. And that was all without public oversight or input, because it was under the banner of hazardous tree removal, which I think is a huge elephant in the room that we need to discuss. So contrast the response that the Detroit Ranger Station had with what happened around Eagle Creek, and you'll see what shouldn't do versus what you should.
Well, Sam, you just broke my heart describing what's going on around Brighton Bush, because I haven't been down there since the fire. But what you're describing maybe is motivation for where we'll go in this show in terms of people really trying to put a stop to this. But in the meantime, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with community organizer Samantha Kropp, who's with Forest Waters. You're describing how well the fire, the Eagle Creek fire, post-mortem was managed by the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area, it's a protected area. And that, I think, in itself speaks volumes about how important it is to protect these incredible forests. However, our former Oregon Congressman Greg Walden was trying very hard to get a waiver to be able to log in this National Scenic Area, which prohibits logging. Fortunately, he was stopped from that, but there were a lot of Republicans on board right after that fire. What can be done? Because most of these lands are not protected in the same way that the gorge is protected.
Yeah, it's a really complicated thing how our lands are managed, the distinction between different kinds of federal land managed for different things. Different kinds of, we have state lands, and then like I said earlier, we've got these private lands that are so many owned by industrial forest managers who hardly, you know, we have really insufficient laws protecting us from the things that they can do. So, you know, thankfully we do have a process right now for engaging in public lands defense. And there's many, many folks who are working really hard to try and do just that. There's people who live in communities who are nearby and who are reliant upon, like I said, kind of Eugene with the drinking water and pulling their drinking water from the Mackenzie, a burned watershed. And those that community working really hard to engage with the Bureau of Land Management, the Springfield Agency Office, and say, we really, you know, we need you to not do these 10,000 or these thousands of acres of logging, you know, along the Mackenzie. We need you to take care of our watershed. And so right now, the comment period for that, for a number of the logging projects that are currently proposed along the Mackenzie and along the North Umpqua River, both Bureau of Land Management lands, that comment period is open. And the community should weigh in. And if people want to get in touch with me and get the nitty gritty on how to do that, please feel free to do that. I can share my email at the end, and I'm sure it can be posted elsewhere. But I would say it's so important to let these agencies know what it is that we think should happen with our drinking watersheds. And that goes for Bureau of Land Management, and it also goes for the Forest Service agencies, like I mentioned, the Willamette National Forest Detroit Ranger Station really needs to hear from people about why they should, you know, why they made a mistake with that hazard tree removal the way they did it, and they should be more thoughtful if they do have to do it in the future, and why they certainly now should not be proposing any salvage logging proposals, which they haven't yet but may. And so just communities kind of holding decision makers accountable is one way that I think it's so, so very important. And I will say too that there are a number of organizations, even you know, BARC, who's local to Portland, who are doing an awesome job of engaging, you know, with, they're engaging with the Mount Hood National Forest on behalf of the fire impacted landscape there, and Cascadia Wildlands and Oregon Wild and other organizations who are monitoring every timber sale proposal happening. So if you're a person who wants to get involved, again, I certainly encourage you to reach out and connect to me, look up those organizations, because those management agencies, they don't make it user-friendly to email them necessarily. They don't make it user-friendly to navigate their timber sale proposals. But there are others doing that work, and we really need more grassroots voices weighing in. So that's one way to do something about the public lands that are currently being proposed for logging.
Well, I can put your email on our website for the show, and people can contact you. I know that after this interview, you've got a hearing that you're going to, or at least you're going to be there virtually. And tell me, what kind of hearings are you going to right now, and what is happening right at this moment to stop these potential timber sales and this post-fire logging?
There's a lot of action opportunities happening. There's a flurry of activity happening in the state legislature. So the state legislature is, you know, overseeing all of this money for fire recovery that they haven't yet decided what to do with. And so we community members are trying to say, hey, state, you know, if you're going to use money on fire recovery, please, please, please don't use it for logging in the name of fire prevention, which is a whole nother, you know, part of the silly puzzle is that. And so there's going to be a lot of efforts and important time for community to kind of step in and say, we need these funds for rebuilding our communities, for creating fireproof and firewise communities. You know, there's a concept that's currently in the legislature that's fascinating called the Fire Corps, which is modeled off of the Civilian Conservation Corps and the new, you know, Climate Corps proposal. But it's a statewide piece of legislation that would, you know, create funding for people to work with prescribed fire on the land to, you know, help mitigate the impacts of severe fire in the on season, and also who would create defensible space around communities and kind of do all of that work that actually needs to be done in order for our communities to thrive with fire, instead of pouring state funding into logging in the name of fire prevention or logging in the name of salvaging wood after a fire. You know, that's such a waste of funds. So that a lot of that is happening in the state legislature right now. There's a lot of energy around asking the state to use common sense, community-centered tactics to support our to prepare for wildfire seasons to come.
Are there any proposed bills?
Yes. Yeah, so the Fire Corps is a bill, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I'd be happy to follow up with that. We also, there is a, the governor has kind of put out kind of like a large, broad bill that is going to be amended heavily, I'm sure, over the course of the next month. But there's essentially a legislative wildfire committee that is responsible for developing this policy. And Senator Jeff Golden is the chair of that committee. And he's a wonderful, actually a great ally in the legislature and someone to support and also encourage to really fight for us, because there's not a lot, not a ton of allies in that committee. And they really are going to be setting the state level legislation for, you know, what we're going to invest in for future fire seasons.
Well, one of the issues here in Oregon, and this goes way back before your time here, is that Oregon for 100 years and more was basically a timber state, and timber ruled. And it was like that when I came here in 1971. And I've watched with a bit of guarded joy how the tone has shifted and there's a lot more voices, and it's not just the timber industry running everything. And in fact, until 1990, there was not a single person that I'm aware of who ran for statewide office who won, who wasn't in the pocket of the timber industry. That person who defied that mold was Barbara Roberts. But I still see that tension, that there's such emphasis here on timber, even though it reminds me, I did a show last week about coal in West Virginia. And the dying industry of coal in West Virginia is kind of like the logging industry in Oregon, which is certainly not anything like it was before they cut all the trees down, basically. So I wonder, how do you deal with this history, this long history of timber dominating the state? And it still is dominating, and it dominates it economically, it dominates it politically.
Yes, right on. And that's exactly right. It is kind of, in many ways, a David and Goliath battle, trying to elevate the issues of forest defense and community defense in front of a state legislature that has historically been dominated by and influenced heavily by the timber industry. And I would, you know, also point out that, like you said, things are definitely changing, and that's really encouraging. We do have allies on the state level. We have allies on the federal level. And we have more and more, we have exciting grassroots allies on the local level, people who are running for local positions at the county and city level who are activists and who are seeing that, you know, sometimes you got to get in there with your community to make those changes. But I will also say that, you know, speaking of the state, the Oregon Department of Forestry is currently run by someone who has, Peter Dougherty, who has historically proven himself unwilling to take any action in defense of Oregon's forests. And right now, under his leadership, the Oregon Department of Forestry is proposing all of that logging that I mentioned earlier in the fire-impacted forests in the Santiam State Forest, along all this recreation area. And so, you know, he and many others, we're about to see a brand new slate come in for the Oregon Board of Forestry. Actually, by the time this is put out, there will be a new slate for the Oregon Board of Forestry that oversees the Department of Forestry, and that will include some more allies for us, and that's really good. I'll also say that, you know, even here in Portland, going down to, you know, Ted Wheeler, our mayor, who comes from timber money and timber influence, you know, it is quite insidious and happens at every level, and it is up to us and all of us to point that out and how it's time for a change.
Well, how do you think that Ted Wheeler affects forest policy in the state of Oregon, or is it just his family connections that are the concern?
I think that citywide officials and their value systems are an important statement and reflection on the value systems of the people, their constituents, and also the value systems that the county and the states should adopt. And so even on a citywide level, there are plenty of cities across the state who are fighting right now to protect their drinking water supplies from the impacts of clear-cut logging, like Rockaway Beach, like Corbett, Oregon, you know, in our backyard. And so, yes, I think that Ted Wheeler's historical positionality as, you know, a timber family does, you know, it says something to our neighbors. And I think it's important that, you know, if that's where he's coming from, he stand up and say, that's not okay. And, you know, do what he can to put his foot down and gain protections. We're lucky here in Portland because we have a protected drinking watershed, but our neighbors don't. And it's up to all levels of officials to say something about that.
Actually, it was only about 30 years ago that there was logging going on in the Bull Run watershed under the auspices of former Mayor Ivensee. And it was easy money for the city. And it was when it was finally revealed that this was going on, and there's a huge outcry. And actually, I think Mark Hatfield intervened and created a federal law which prohibits logging in Bull Run. But there were years when there was a lot of sediment in that water as a result. So even our protected water can be at danger.
Yeah, and it's actually such an inspiring history, this one. Like you said, it was a hard-fought protection, and it wasn't just automatically. Portland was born and its water was protected from clear-cut logging. People fought for that who loved this watershed, and now it is protected. And I would say that, you know, Portland is also a really affluent, you know, tying this back to issues of environmental justice and issues of intersectionality. You know, Portland is a very, you know, more affluent, more liberal place. And these other communities that are fighting real, real hard, and they're actually, you know, places like Rockaway Beach, 95% of their watershed has been clear cut. And, you know, these are a lot of like rural communities, coastal communities who have been trying for decades. Triangle Lake outside of Eugene, where I used to live, has been speaking out against the impacts of chemical spray in their drinking water when their community members have tested positive for 2,4-D and atrazine in their urine, which, by the way, are both chemical components of Agent Orange. And so, you know, people have been speaking out about this. I'll leave it there. People have been speaking out about this for a long time, and not everyone has been so successful as Portland in gaining protection. So it is up to us Portlanders to get their backs.
Well, I watched that logging going on up above Rockaway for years and years. I was happy to see that people were finally objecting to it. But I mean, it's been going on for a really long time. And Rockaway was a really different place in the 70s than it was even in the 90s. So sometimes, I mean, I appreciate when these communities get on board, but maybe we can help them to get on board a little sooner. Anyway, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with community organizer Samantha Kropp, who's with Forest Waters. Well, I wanted to close out today by getting back to fire and talking about another issue that's really kind of challenging when we're talking about getting people to appreciate the importance and the value of wildfires. And that is that people think that burnt forests are ugly and that there's a big loss. And for the picture for this show that I put on the web, it's a shot that I took a few months ago up Oneonta Gorge in the Columbia Gorge, and it's just a few miles from Eagle Creek. And that whole, what was incredibly verdant, incredibly green, incredibly full of life gorge was basically burned out, and all the moss was gone. I mean, this stuff is starting to come back now after 3 years. And I was taking this picture, and I was feeling sort of sad, missing what it was like, but I got this incredible sort of an early afternoon sunset because I was shooting into a gorge, and the light was this pastel, incredible pastel light. And I thought, this is something I wouldn't have seen before the fire. So I wonder how we can help people to understand that there's another kind of beauty in burned forests, and that that's something that we really need to embrace.
That is really beautifully put. It reminds me of something that I learned when I was reading this amazing book called The Final Forest, which is really about the logging history of this bioregion. And it talked about how when settlers first came out to this area and started clear-cut logging these giant forests, there was a shared sentiment that the forests were evil and dark and putting out bad energy, that they were kind of wild places that had a darkness about them and that they needed to be tamed. And I, you know, was reading a lot of primary accounts of journals of, you know, women who, you know, are in their homes surrounded by forests and writing about how the forests are scary and how, you know, they don't like the darkness. And I think that, you know, it just goes to show that our sentiments towards things aren't always a reflection necessarily of what's good and right in nature. They're often a reflection of the stories that our society puts out there to justify its own actions. And so that justified logging old growth forests. And now, you know, our fear of fire, our fear mongering around fire, and our internal kind of disdain for it justifies the destruction of these complex and very unique and very important post-fire ecosystems. And so I actually have tried a little experiment on myself, because I also, you know, have historically been one of those people who saw burned landscapes and said, ooh, you know, I don't know about that. But I've started to really appreciate, to look closer, to look more deeply, to learn about what's happening. And I am fascinated by how incredibly complex, beautiful, interesting a post-fire landscape can be. And now I look at even the most severely burned forests and I see all of the life coming back, and it makes me feel good about the cycle. And so I challenge all of you listeners to try that as well, because the future is gonna have wildfire. We have to learn how to respect it, how to thrive with it, and how to focus our work on our communities.
Well, I'm just remembering as you're talking about when I first came to Portland in the early 70s, and I came from California, but very short time there. Mainly I'd grown up in the East Coast, where there are no forests that you could even begin to compare to the forests on the West Coast. And they were very neat, they're pine forests, and they didn't have a whole lot of understory, or at least that never grew back after they were clear cut. So I was on top of Hamilton Mountain in the gorge, and I was actually tripping on acid. And I looked in one direction, and I saw the Bonneville Dam, which I didn't know enough at that point to realize it wasn't part of nature. But I think I was getting some weird energy from the dam. And then I looked on the other side, and there was this amazing burn. And it was the Yelkult burn, which was still very visible until the mid-70s. And the burn really disturbed me. It actually disturbed me a lot more than the Bonneville Dam did. And it just made me, I actually kind of turned that trip into a very kind of scary trip. And I had to get down off the mountain because I was so freaked out by looking at that burn. And then fast forward to 2012, a year after the Dahl Lake fire on Mount Hood, on the north face of Mount Hood. And it burned my favorite trail that goes up on the north face, the Vista Ridge Trail. But as I was going through the burn, I had this funny thought about how I'd been annoyed by all these trees that had grown up in the last 40 years that had obscured the views, the vista that for which that trail was named. And also just looking at the different colors and shapes of the burn trees and watching the stages of the bark peeling off and the different colors they go through, and then seeing blackback woodpeckers up there, actually. And every time I've gone up there since, I've just been so excited to see how this forest is coming back. And I know it's not going to ever look like it did when I was hiking there 40 years ago. It's not going to look like that in my lifetime. But there's this whole other stage that we go through. How would you walk somebody through that process?
The process of forest recovery?
It's not just the forest recovery, but the process of recovering with the forest.
I think that, like I said, you know, it has to be about looking closer and being willing to learn and pay attention. I was really reacting to the kind of the acid trippy visceral reaction that you had to the burn. And I was thinking about, you know, I don't have an acid trip story, but I do know I used to teach high school, and my high school students, when I took them to a clear cut, had a very visceral reaction to the clear cut. I hope they weren't on acid, but they all had a very visceral, like, oh my God, what was going on? What's going on here? It hurt. It really affected them. I remember taking them and just, we went to an old growth forest. Actually went to Hardesty Mountain, which we can thank forest defenders of decades past for saving, so that we can enjoy the old growth there now. But we went there and we walked around, and then we got to the top of the ridge and it opened up into a really young plantation, and there was some clear cuts nearby. And the plantation forest was like maybe 10 years old, 20 years old, very young, very dark, very, you know, no underbrush, soil really compact. There was a lot of plastic lying around from all the trees that had been kind of caged. And the students were just yuck, viscerally upset by that. And we didn't even have to talk about it, you know, in there. We unpacked that later. And so I think that, you know, the closer they looked, the more yuck they felt. And the closer they looked at the old growth forest, the more that they were just wow. And that has been my experience with post-fire forests, is that the closer I look, the more wowed I am and the less yucked I am. You know, first reaction, oh, wow, you know, we're affected by it. But again, look at the Eagle Creek fire area just a few years after the burn. It burned in such a beautiful mosaic. And I just love going into that area and seeing what was spared and what was taken down and what's coming back, and how so many of those standing dead snags are now home to woodpecker or used by woodpecker and home to all these other creatures. And it's just, you know, it's more than just the one moment after the fire. It's about all the things that come next. So be patient and pay attention.
Well, I had another experience that you reminded me of, which was to see the difference between post-fire logging and see an area that was protected from that. And that's the Babyfoot Trail to Babyfoot Lake down the Biscuit Burn, which was the place where I started learning about the importance of fire when I did a project on that many years ago. And at the head of that trail is this horrible and actually illegal clear cut that happened. And it's very disturbing. And you can see that that's not going to grow back. But then as we hiked along the trail, and I had a really great guy, this guy Rolf Scar, who was working with an environmental organization in Southern Oregon at that time. And he was pointing out everything that was coming back. And the bear grass was incredible. And the Venetian blind effect, which is, he described all these snags that are growing up and the way the light is, there's this incredible array of light and shadow. And then you get to the lake, and the lake, of course, is a oasis. The trees didn't burn around the lake. You could see that you're going through a very special area. And so to me, there was such a contrast between the part of the forest that wasn't logged and the part that was. That was a lesson. I wonder, have you taken anybody to see those lessons?
Yeah, I used to work with Cascadia Wildlands as their grassroots outreach person. And now in my new position, it's been COVID. So it's been hard to get out into the woods with people, which has been one of the saddest parts. But more and more, we're developing better COVID protocol, and we're doing small COVID safe trips out there. And we love to do post-fire hikes. That's the best part. And we love to walk through areas that have been allowed to recover and areas that were not, and to compare and to feel and to notice the difference. One of my favorite places around Eugene that I used to go to with folks was Fall Creek, where there was two fires actually. One that came a bit earlier, and the second, which was like much more severe, and they overlap in a specific part. And it was just fascinating to see what was already coming back in that really beloved recreation area. So yeah, I recommend people to go out there and poke around in the forest. You know, a lot of the ones that burned in 2020 are still closed to the public, but as much as you can, you know, don't just listen to the rhetoric coming from the timber industry that says these forests are dangerous, these forests are dead, they need our help to recover. Go check it out. See for yourself. There's a lot coming back right now.
Well, next, I recommend going on the Joaquina Falls Trail in the gorge, because that one is just, it's just a beautiful example of the best of fire. The Oneana Gorge Trail, it's a little bit harder to take, but there are some beautiful parts there too. Well, Samantha, it's really great to talk to you, and happy International Women's Day to you and to all of our listeners, and keep us posted about what you're doing in the woods.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with community organizer Samantha Kropp with Forest Waters. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Bob Salinger and Memelang Memela about a new vision for the Portland Harbor. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Joni Mitchell and Willie Nelson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Taste of water.